Well, hello and welcome. Thank you for joining me today for episode number 12 of the Healthy Skeptic MD podcast. I'm Dr. Michael Hochman. We have a special episode today as we head into the Thanksgiving break. I'm going to focus on homeless healthcare. My guests today are three frontline clinicians who are going to give us a firsthand account about just how challenging it can be to deal with medical issues on the streets of Los Angeles. My first guest is Mr. Brett Feldman. He's a physician assistant, and he is the inaugural director of the Street Medicine Program at the Keck School of Medicine at the University of Southern California. My other two guests are both primary care doctors, Dr. Stephen Hochman and Dr. Hannah Siegel Hochman. They are both primary care doctors at the Community Health Center, JWCH, which focuses on homeless health care in Los Angeles. In full disclosure, they are my brother and sister-in-law, but it is a great discussion, so please do stick around for that. If you do like what you hear today, please do search and subscribe to the Healthy Skeptic MD wherever it is that you listen to podcasts, or you can search and subscribe to the Healthy Skeptic MD YouTube channel. Okay, so before we jump into today's interview, as always, let's do a quick rundown of the health news for the week. Of course, the media has been discussing quite a bit the rising rates of COVID-19, and I've been telling my patients, please do take this very seriously. Wash your hands, wear those masks, do the social distancing, double down on these measures as we see these rates rising. But do not panic. And the reason not to panic is rarely in healthcare is panic a good thing, and it can also have its own set of downsides when we overreact. So what I think we should be doing now from a public health standpoint is everything feasible to avoid another one of those stay-at-home orders, which could have very negative implications for our mental health, psychological health, domestic violence rates, drug overdoses, and of course, our economy. And these things are very important too. So what does this mean? We really just need to stick with those simple things that work and be vigilant about them. The masks, the distancing, the hand washing. We may even need to do a couple extra measures such as a curfew, like shutting down at 10 p.m. That's being discussed at Los Angeles. These things all sound annoying, but they are in the name of preventing another one of those stay-at-home orders going into place. But there is good news. On the plus side, we, of course, have great results from Pfizer and Moderna. The Pfizer vaccine may be available for an emergency use authorization within the next couple weeks. This is great news for the general lay public because it means that healthcare workers may be getting it very soon. And this will allow us healthcare workers to really be guinea pigs again. We want as much safety data as possible before this vaccine goes out widely to the general lay public, and with a bunch of healthcare workers potentially getting the vaccine soon, this will provide a lot of additional data points. So this is all great news. There are also two non-COVID studies that I briefly want to allude to this week. The first has to do with appendicitis, which is responsible for a large number of surgeries each year in the United States. A very interesting study was the lead article in the New England Journal of Medicine, and it compared surgical treatment with antibiotics alone. And surprisingly, they found that ultimately most patients with antibiotic treatment did just as well as those who received surgery. Now, for most patients, surgery is still going to make the most sense. It's the fastest way to resolve the problem and get on with your normal life. But I do think it is very relevant to know that there's another safe approach, antibiotic treatment for appendicitis. This is helpful for someone who really wants to avoid surgical treatment for whatever reason, or for a frail older person who would have a hard time undergoing surgery. So good to know in case you or a family member ever does experience appendicitis to know that you do have an alternative option. The second study that I want to mention was in one of the JAMA journals. It has to do with statin medications. Those are those cholesterol medications that are one of the few treatments in medicine that has actually been shown to extend life in rigorous studies. So it's been well established that statins are very effective in preventing recurrent heart attacks and strokes in those who have already had a cardiovascular event, but there's been more controversy about their use in those without a history of a heart attack or stroke, whether the benefits may outweigh the risks. So this was a summary study or a meta-analysis of 8 trials in high-risk adults, 50 to 75. These were people who did not have a cardiac history themselves, but were at high risk for high blood pressure, diabetes, other factors like that. And they found that you would need to treat 100 adults for 2.5 years to prevent one heart attack or stroke or other cardiac event. There was no clear evidence that the statins extended life over that time period. So clearly there is some benefit to these medications, even in those who have not previously had a heart attack or stroke. But I do find these results humbling. This is not a total game changer. And it just highlights once again, as I always tell my patients, medications are the band-aid, but the real treatment is those lifestyle changes, exercise, eating healthy. And that's going to have a much more significant impact in preventing complications in the future than any pill that you could possibly take. So with that, let's move on to our interview today on homeless healthcare. Okay, well, welcome to the Healthy Skeptic MD, Stephen, Hannah, and Brett. Nice to see you.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
Well, thanks for all that you do, and especially this Thanksgiving week. I know everybody appreciates the hard work that you all do for a very challenging population of patients. So, Brett, let me start with you. You run a street medicine program at the Keck School of Medicine of USC. Can you tell me what street medicine is? How would you define it?
Sure. So street medicine recognizes that people experiencing homelessness, especially those who are unsheltered, really have a very difficult time accessing the traditional healthcare system. So we feel it's our duty to leave the comfort of our offices and go to the people on the streets, under the bridges, in the woods, behind the dumpster, wherever they are, with the goal of first delivering a tender love to them, and then full service primary care on the street the best that we can. We know that healthcare is more than just the visit, so we dispense medications, draw labs, we can do point of care ultrasound on the street, EKGs and other diagnostic studies, but the whole idea being that we want to suspend our reality and meet the patient in their reality where they feel comfortable.
And next question that just comes up is, why does the Keck School of Medicine fund a street medicine program? What's the mission of it? What's the motivation for funding this program?
So it started back a few years ago, and USC came out with these five wicked problems. Wicked in that they were both bad and also seemingly almost impossible to solve. And the provost challenged every school in USC to figure out what they were going to do, depending on whatever their skill set was, to solve these problems. And homelessness was one of those problems. So Dean Mosqueda and Dr. Robinson, who's the chair of the Family Medicine Department, knew that in order to really make an impact, they needed to have something that was kind of radical and also a little bit subversive of the system.
It's not typical for a university or an academic medical center to fund a program like this. So it's really great that you made it happen and that they were able to move you out from Allentown, Pennsylvania and in LA. And we'll come back to a little bit more about some of the differences in your experiences. But now let me jump over to Hannah and Stephen. First, Hannah, could you tell me a little bit about the organization you work for, JWCH?
Sure. So JWCH, as an organization, dates back to the 60s, but they opened the clinic on Skid Row in the 90s in response to a need that the county identified to have a clinic that served the homeless population there. And now it's a pretty diverse organization with more than 10 clinics that each one is tailored to the community that it's in. And I would say what really defines JWCH is that it's a service organization and each clinic has responded to the needs that it's found where it is. So in the 90s, they said we need HIV care and they became a big HIV clinic. That was an identification that we needed to think of healthcare in a more expanded way. And so they adopted the PATH clinic where they could do focus on homeless housing, but also social work and providing basic needs like showers. And then more recently, they've expanded addiction medicine services in response to the opiate epidemic. So it's a very responsive organization.
Yeah, well, JWCH over the last couple of decades has really become known as the homeless healthcare provider. You know, certainly a lot of different groups are providing care for homeless patients in LA County, some of the community health centers and other safety net groups. But JWCH is sort of synonymous with the homeless healthcare here. And it's, of course, one of the biggest homeless populations in the country. So Stephen, Hannah mentions Skid Row, which actually is one of the largest and densest populations of homeless people anywhere in the country. You work at a clinic on Skid Row. Tell some of the listeners who are not from LA what Skid Row is and what it looks like.
Yeah. So Skid Row is sort of a designated area. Well, it's not designated officially, but it's an area of the city where a lot of folks who have no other place to live have gone to seek their own form of shelter. You know, Skid Row is definitely a dramatic and a drastic place to witness on a daily basis. Definitely a culture shock for a lot of people. Interestingly, it's located within a few blocks of some very affluent areas of downtown. So it really is the type of situation where you can take a single turn and find yourself in a very different neighborhood. You know, I think the thing that jumps out to most people when they first come to Skid Row is are the obvious issues of substance abuse and mental health that present themselves right in the street. There's a lot of people with active psychosis who are sort of talking to themselves and doing those things that are very noticeable. It's very easy to see someone with a needle in their arm or someone buying drugs in the street. But actually something that I've come to learn over the last year and a half of working there is there's also just a lot of people living. There's people at 10 a.m. on a morning talking to their friends and having coffee and, you know, without the luxury of a shelter for them to do that within or, you know, the finances to do that at a coffee, you see them on the street. And, you know, we have a lovely outreach worker at our clinic, Chris Mack, who has a history of homelessness himself, and now he works for us. And, you know, when I went there, one of the first things he offered me was, you know, he said, "Steven, you want to come walk the street with me?" And since then, I really count myself as incredibly lucky to have walked the street with him two or three times and just meet the people he sees out there. And they're just people trying to live their daily lives. Their daily life might include taking advantage of things like the Refresh Spot, which is an outdoor area for showers and washing clothes, or it might just be having coffee with some friends on the street. But, you know, the density of that in Skid Row is certainly really stark and a lot to deal with, especially when you add the mental health and substance abuse issues on top of that.
Well, in some ways, it sounds like JWCH did something very similar to, Brett, what your team did in street medicine. They brought a medical clinic right where the patients who live on the streets are right there in Skid Row. And so it really has become the healthcare provider for that community there. So Brett, 2020 has been a challenging year across the board for all of us, but it's hit some of the vulnerable communities the hardest. And from your vantage point as a street medicine clinician, how has the COVID-19 pandemic impacted the homeless populations? And do you think it's increased the number of people who are homeless and the difficulty of their lives?
So it's interesting because LA, and this has been demonstrated in other cities across the country, the unsheltered homeless has really not been impacted by COVID-19 itself. However, they've been very impacted by stay-at-home orders and other like of these secondary things and stopping the pandemic. So in general, COVID has caused a fundamental shift in how we think about ourselves as street medicine clinicians. When it started, it was really about primary care. And then we found ourselves having to learn how to do disaster preparedness. From the street perspective, the people we served really had two different reactions. The first one was one of very intense fear, as was most of us. So, you know, as we talked about, Skid Row is really as close to hell on earth as you will see. It's almost like a congregate shelter, but in an outside setting. But something to remember about LA County is that for the unsheltered, less than 10% are on Skid Row. So that means over 90% are outside of Skid Row, and some live in these very remote areas where they're already in a cruel way socially distanced at baseline, which is probably the main reason why, and they're outside, why COVID-19 itself hasn't hit. So for those people, they were getting at baseline 2 to 3 meals a week, to be honest. And then versus on Skid Row, where typically food is readily available. But what we saw happening is the whole world was staying in. So panhandling was a lot less. People are not able to get enough money through panhandling to afford food, the typical places where they would get clean water or use the bathroom, the restaurants were closed. I remember one particular patient, we all went through this period where it was tough to get toilet paper, but for them it was much longer because they didn't have access to even the bathrooms or the finances to buy toilet paper. And we had dropped off socks for him, a whole pack of socks on Tuesday. Came to see him again on Friday for wound care, and he asked for more socks. And I said, what happened to the other socks? And he kind of shamefully explained to me that he had to use them for toilet paper where he was going under the underpants. So there were these secondary effects, but there was this real concern for starvation in some of the places outside of downtown. And then the second effect was really one where it didn't impact their lives at all. So they have daily threats to their health and safety every day. So for them, the threshold of what is going to be a threat enough for them to pay attention to is much higher than you and I. So when we talk to them about COVID, they're like, yeah, that's great. But I every day have to worry about being assaulted, having all my stuff stolen or swept out. So those are the things that are more proximal to my issues.
Yeah, it's interesting. I remember when the pandemic first hit in March and April, there was a big concern that the homeless populations were going to be big sites of outbreaks. And there certainly have been a few here and there, and even in some shelters. But based on what you're saying and what I've heard as well, is some of the biggest problems have been, some of the shutdowns and the limited access to some of these services that homeless individuals rely on. That's been almost a bigger challenge for that population. Well, Stephen and Hannah, how about you? How has the COVID-19 pandemic impacted your interaction with patients?
It's definitely increase the degree of difficulty. I think, Michael, something you just mentioned was sort of access to county services. And, a lot of our patients have had difficulties interacting with, formal services to get things like IDs or paperwork in the best of times. And, walking them through that has always been difficult. It was difficult, when I started working here before COVID. And, now it can be almost impossible. And, just to walk them through it, because even when the services are available, it's just so difficult for them to interface with the COVID restrictions. And so, one of the things I do a lot of is I'm a substance abuse provider on Skid Row, and I provide patients with medication assisted treatment to try to help them with their opiate addiction. And there's a federal law that you need a government picture ID in order to pick up your Suboxone. And I think there's some very good reasons that's the law. But many of my patients, like Brett was alluding to before, they have their IDs stolen. They lose all their things in a street cleaning or something like that. They don't have an ID. And then someone who's been stable off of opiates for, several months, who loses an ID, can no longer pick up their prescription. And surprise, surprise, without the medicine that's been helping them, they relapse. And so, that's one specific example, but access to services has been really difficult. Also, another thing I'd add that's interesting is many of my patients don't have sort of the same access to 24/7 news bombarding them that we've been having. And so, early on, there were some who were perceived as not taking it seriously, when really, I just don't think even though they were living right in downtown Los Angeles, I'm not sure they had quite the sense of how dramatic the situation was. And even now, when big things happen like vaccine news, they come and they don't necessarily know. And so, a big part of my job is just spending some time trying to educate them. Why do we care so much about wearing masks in the clinic? Why is it so important to cover your nose and mouth? Things like that is a big issue. I don't know, Hannah, if you have.
Yeah, and I think Brett alluded to this before, but I think these people are very isolated, and the times that used to break up their isolation when they did access services, some of those disappeared overnight for them. And I have heard from people just a new overwhelming sense of loneliness and kind of that isolation bringing on more depression and sadness when, they come to the doctor and it used to be a place where they got to talk to somebody, and now there's a mask and people are trying to have limited interaction and time, and we don't get to do some of those things that we used to do to help, bring dignity to the situation, like giving a handshake or sitting next to them and things that maybe didn't happen for them on a regular basis that now aren't okay because of COVID.
Hannah, you do a lot. You're certified as an internal medicine doctor and as a pediatrician, and I know you have a good number of children in your practice. What's been some of the impact on children? And maybe just tell us a little bit about what it's like to care for children who are homeless.
A lot of the children that we see, they may not be out on the streets, kind of the way that we've been talking about with the other more obviously homeless patients, but they often have home insecurity or living in places that wouldn't meet our criteria for being a home. So like I recently talked to a family of six that's living in a one bedroom apartment with no kitchen. And I was trying to engage the family in a discussion about healthy eating because we'd identified a lot of obesity in their family. And the 12-year-old said, you know, I love vegetables. And my favorite day is that twice a month we get to use our friend's kitchen and my mom makes vegetable soup. But every other day of the month, we eat packaged fast food because we have no way to make food for ourselves. And it's really hard to give any sort of advice to people who are going through that because they're doing the best they can. They're feeding their kids and they just don't have a way to feed their kids something healthy. Those sorts of challenges are really hard. And I think for kids in this situation with COVID, when their home didn't used to provide all of the things they needed, they would get them at school or in after school programs or in daycare programs. And having all of those shut down is really devastating. And the rates of depression and anxiety amongst kids and their parents, I don't have data, but it feels like it's a staggering increase. Almost every family is bringing it up. And we, as a clinic, are increasing our therapy resources and offering telehealth therapy, which is actually a nice new thing, enabling us to reach out to a lot more people. I've made a note to make sure that that's addressed very formally in every visit that I have now, but it's certainly a new burden that we are needing to figure out how to address, and we haven't entirely figured out how to do it well yet.
Well, I have to say, just hearing all three of you, it's remarkable what you do on a day-to-day basis and what you see. And again, just, you know, the appreciation from all of us is great, especially this Thanksgiving season, but throughout the year. Let me bring the discussion to a different level, the policy level. Federal officials, state officials, local officials make decisions that impact the lives of the homeless. From your vantage point, what policy changes could be made that would make life easier and better for individuals living on the streets? Maybe Brett, we can start with you on this one.
Yeah, there's a lot. I think just from a general approach standpoint, Of course, job loss is a major driver for homelessness, but when you get out onto the street, the people that are unsheltered, unable to self-resolve out of homelessness, then healthcare is a major driver. You have high rates of physical disability, intellectual disability, mental illness, drug use disorder. And from an approach standpoint, so far we've started with social services, which I think needs to be a part of it. But the healthcare has really been seen almost like a disaster situation. You know, there's been a lot of dollars coming in for healthcare for COVID specifically, but 1,000 people died on the streets of LA last year, and the commitment to ongoing healthcare on the street just hasn't been part of the policy. So what happens is, in a place like LA where you have a severe housing shortage, the folks that are going to be on the street are going to be there a while. And if there's not healthcare being provided on the street, then you end up pairing healthcare with housing, where housing has to be a prerequisite in order to obtain the healthcare that you need, even though you're so sick on the street. So I think how we approach the problem of homelessness, not prevention, but once they're homeless, needs to involve more ongoing healthcare.
I think one thing we do at JWCH, just that you reminded me of, Brett, is We are always making sure that we're addressing preventative care with our homeless patients. So we're not putting it off and saying, like, once you get a home, then you'll get your colonoscopy. Like, we're and our boss, Dr. Gregerson, is great about this. He's always driving into his providers that we need to be doing the standard of care that you would be doing for anybody, regardless of who they are, for our patients.
Yeah, and the data really supports that. I mean, there's really only been one study looking at causes of death for the unsheltered homeless, which was out of Boston. The number one cause, the number one and two were cancer and heart disease. In LA, the number one cause of death was heart disease, and it's actually the number one diagnosis that we treat.
Yeah, I think those are the one and two causes of death for the general population too. So it's very interesting that aligns. Stephen, anything to add on this one?
So, you know, I think I was really actually moved by one of the Healthy Skeptic MD podcasts with Dr. Jane, I think last week or the week before, about, you know, radical common sense. And I think we need a lot of that with the homeless population. Completely seconding what Brett and Hannah have said, you know, treating heart disease, doing cancer screening, doing cervical cancer screening, you know, all that stuff is very important. But, you know, sort of coming up against a brick wall of some of the unique needs of these patients and, you know, being able to get an insurance company to pay for things that a patient needs, like socks, might be a good decision. You know, one thing I often say is, you know, what some of these patients need a little bit is maybe a little bit of a sort of a mother or a father type character. And really that would be the case manager in this case. And, you know, giving case managers the time and you know, giving them the appropriate compensation to deal with the difficulty of the job they're providing, I think will help a lot, because I can spend a great 15 or 20 minutes with a patient. We could do, you know, med rec. We can figure out all the things they need. But if they go out on the street and they can't remember, they can't communicate, or they can't get to their appointments, a lot of that time is lost. The other thing that comes to mind that I think a lot about is I think as a country, we need to reevaluate how we think about mental illness, and especially severe debilitating mental illness. We all have this morbid picture of one flew over the cuckoo's nest as the only way to, you know, to quote, commit somebody. And I think, you know, I think we just need to have a discussion of a country of how we can care for our very actively psychotic patients in a caring, thoughtful, and helpful way, you know, and support them. And that might require working with them on sort of keeping them on their medicines with a little bit more oversight. But, you know, how can we do that in a way? And I just think it's a discussion we need to sort of have as a community and adjust our policies so that we can sort of help these patients more.
Well, we just had a big election in this country and have a whole new set of politicians in place. And gosh, I really hope that some of these new policymakers who are coming in will talk to people like you who are on the front lines and figure out what practical solutions make sense. And as I hear you all talk, I think you're exactly right that a lot of these things are not liberal ideas or conservative ideas. They're just common sense ideas. So, you know, hopefully they'll reach out and get thoughts from people who are working on the front lines on these challenges. Well, I have two more questions for each of you. The first is, you know, you're all highly trained medical professionals. You could have done a lot of things with your career, but you decided to focus on a very challenging population. What inspired you to go into the field of homeless medicine, starting with you, Brett?
So I found that that street medicine providers, but not just us, many others, usually have three motivations. One is duty, where we see, you know, I'm in medicine, the people on the streets are extremely sick, so it's my duty to go to them. Another one is justice, where you see a group that has been wronged and you want to right that wrong. And then the last one is love, where you see a group that is really suffering and your desire is to ease that suffering. And I think for me, it was probably started out as duty, where the folks that I met on the street were just really, really sick. And you know, I started with a shelter-based clinic and found that we were tied to the shelter. And when folks left the shelter, we would lose them as patients. And I knew how sick they were and decided to follow them out onto the street. But as time goes on, it shifted much more towards love, where, you know, as we're suspending our reality and meeting them in their reality, you see all the suffering that reality brings them. And we really want to share that with them and try and relieve some of that for them. So that's the main driver. That's the best way that I've found to heal, because it, you know, material poverty, is one thing, and we can fix that with a home and some food, but it's that spiritual poverty that takes time to heal.
I think Brett is exactly right. You know, I think the first thing that drew me, into this type of medicine was just, you know, a desire to give back. I think it's worth just, you know, being honest with yourself. I think that, you know, and I've been blessed in my life, to have had a lot of things that made it easy to get to where I am. And, you know, I think I still worked hard, but, you know, a lot of things that my patients don't have. And I just think, you know, having gotten those things myself, I think it's 100% my duty to give back. Specifically for homeless health care in Los Angeles, I was really moved by my experiences as a med student. I was a med student at the Keck School of Medicine. I worked in the county hospital, a building where I have some incredibly fond memories, but also some really, you know, heartbreaking memories of remembering taking care of patients and working so hard on a hospitalization for a couple of days or a week, and then knowing that out in the street they might not get the follow-up they needed, they might not be able to stick with their follow-up appointments or take their medications, and thinking, gee, you know, if someone, if there were someone out there who this hospitalized case could be handed off to, you know, maybe we could make that easier, and we could keep the progress, you know, keep making progress in the right direction. It's a really funny population. I mean, you know, they're sometimes they're honest in a way you don't expect them to be honest. You know, they jab me and have interactions with me in the clinic that just, you know, make me smile and make me laugh. I think about it. I immediately started keeping a journal when I started working here, just because, you know, when I have grandkids someday, I hope I want to be able to tell them some of the silly things I saw in clinic. And I think, you know, I agree with Brett. It is sort of a hell on earth on Skid Row, but there are definitely bright spots, and it's definitely a lovely community to work with and a great group of people that I think we can help a lot. And I love this job.
Well, I think that's a great perspective to have. And, you know, some of these situations, you can either laugh or cry. And sometimes laughing is a more productive way to deal with these things. And Hannah, how about you?
You know, just like Brett said, for me, it was the justice issue that drew me in. And before I went to med school, I was a history major, studied where does inequality come from in our society and who does it impact? And then kind of towards the end of college, I had this, well, what am I going to do with that? You become a professor and write about it and teach other people about it or find a way to act on it. And for me, that was medicine. So this is something I sort of knew I wanted to do before medical school and then had to go through the process of getting into medical school and doing the training before I got to come back to doing this in my job, you know, 8 years later. And I would just say that to the medical community, there were a lot of people who were discouraging about it. Like when I got to med school, it was like, well, why are you here? And if you said it's for social justice or out of a service orientation, that wasn't interesting to a lot of attendings and teachers. Like they want you to be inspired by an organ or a disease process. And it's not as usual to say that you're inspired by a need. And I think that's really strange and something that the medical community needs to evaluate. And we need to do more asking, you know, what are the needs that we can fill rather than like, are we interested in asthma? Because if a patient has asthma, you should be interested in it. And we need to kind of come more from that perspective. And I think a lot of people who might be interested in this work get discouraged from being interested in it.
You know, Dr. Riley at the Keck School of Medicine, you know, was a really inspiring factor in primary care and underserved primary care. And as a first year before I met her, Hannah was assigned to work in clinic with Dr. Gregerson. And you know, so there are certainly bright spots out there of people who are taking folks like us and, you know, keeping our fire burning.
Yeah, well, I have to say, and I admit my bias up front, all three of you have a Keck School of Medicine connection. Stephen and Hannah, you went there. Brett, you worked there. And I'm, of course, a faculty member there. You know, I do think Keck has done a good job of creating leaders who are interested in vulnerable populations like this. And I'll just say from hearing your stories, it seems like all of you are in healthcare for the right reasons and in homeless medicine for the right reasons. So that's great to hear. So my last question for you is, you know, it is Thanksgiving week and, you know, we're thinking about what we're appreciative for and thankful for. If I could just ask each of you to finish off by saying what has working with homeless populations made you appreciate about your life? And this time, maybe we can start with you, Hannah.
I'm thinking about this question, Mike, and I was thinking, honestly, there are just so many days when I come home and feel drained and down, thinking about the stories that I've heard, the trauma, violence, inequality, and it just, you know, sometimes I notice that it gets to me, and I have this sort of pep talk that I give myself, like, that I just had to hear those stories as a doctor, but I didn't have to live any of them. And how just painful and awful it must be to have to be the people that are actually living through some of these horrible things. And that, you know, it makes me feel thankful every day for all the things I have and grateful, but it also is a daily reminder of how privilege works in our society. And, you know, I have every day think about that I've benefited from the unfortunate institution of white privilege, of socioeconomic privilege, and that the people that we're working with, they often didn't have those privileges, and a small series of wrong turns or bad luck have ended them up in some pretty unfortunate and gruesome situations. And we have to be really dedicated to our work in social justice and righting some of these inequalities and sharing resources so that this stops happening.
There's a lot of improvement that can be done, a lot of policy changes and more that I think can go into fighting this unfortunately still growing problem. But you know, this season I'm really thankful we have a JWCH. I think you know, just being able to have a place to work with the resources we have is really great. Having, you know, buy-in from big academic institutions like Keck, things like that, having people like Brett, you know, taking care of patients on the street who might not make it into clinic. I think I'm really thankful for all those things. Obviously, personally, I am also very thankful for all the wonderful things that I have, you know, a stable shelter, just a place where I can be and relax. I can't tell you how many patients tell me they would give anything for just 20 minutes of quiet time where they could sleep without fear of being attacked or have their things stolen. And you know, to have that is so great. And also just to be, you know, obviously to be together with my family and friends is such a great thing, which is, again, like we were talking about earlier, the isolation of homelessness, to not have that, but just to know that family and friends are nearby and I can always interface with them. And that just means so much to me. So those are the main things I'm thankful for.
What I'm most thankful for are the really important life lessons that our friends on the street have taught me over the years. I remember one of our first patients, his name was Craig. He was, I met him through the consult service, and he was 50, the age that he was supposed to get his first colonoscopy, and came in with belly pain, was found to have just metastatic colon cancer everywhere. And he lived in this drainage pipe for the past 3 years. And we couldn't bear to see him go back out to the drainage pipe where his cancer would progress. And we got him a bed in the inpatient hospice, which typically they don't accept people unless they're expected to pass away within 2 weeks. And he said, "I'm not going." And I said, "What do you mean you're not going?" They were going to let him come and go. It was a great setup. And he said, "You said that people there are going to die within 2 weeks. That means they need it more than I do." And he went back to his drainage pipe. And it just struck me how in his suffering, as he was approaching death, in even in the extreme circumstances, he was able to recognize somebody else's suffering and really show them a tremendous amount of love. So it's lessons like that have really taught me the most about life that I'm thankful for.
Yeah, well, certainly hearing all your stories, it does bring a sense of appreciation, should for all of us, about how lucky we are to have a roof over our heads and the advantages that we have. Well, I thank you all for what you do, Brett, Stephen, and Hannah. You're out there on the front lines and, you know, helping a population that really, really needs it. So thanks for what you do. Thanks to everybody for joining today for the Healthy Skeptic MD. If you liked what you heard today, please do search and subscribe to the Healthy Skeptic MD wherever it is you listen to podcasts or on YouTube. Thanks. Have a great Thanksgiving week, and we'll pick it up again next week. Thanks.